Where are you, Judith Blitchmore? Where are you hiding? You got anything to say? Okay, you'll find raffle tickets on your tables, everyone. Please vote early and vote often. We've got some interesting wines and various other prizes to give away, which Judith will talk about. I'm going to introduce now our guest speaker, Dr. Brendan Nelson. He should, I think, feel at home here in Adelaide, because he went to two high schools here, I believe, and did his Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery studies at Flinders University. He went to medical school, in fact, with my GP, Michael Reed, who at the moment is treating me for a very inflamed knee, which is why I'm hobbling around. It's not that I'm drunk, it's just that I've got a bad knee. Dr. Nelson even shares something else in common with many of us. He was a medical columnist for Women's Day magazine for several years. I'd like to have read some of those. He's also, of course, a former president of the Australian Medical Association. He's addressing us today for the second time, the last time being on the 14th of July 1995, when he was in opposition. And I suspect he will tell us that he's been poor and he's been rich, and being rich is better than being poor. He's been the Liberal member for one of Australia's most blue-ribboned seats, Bradfield, on Sydney's North Shore, where my mum still lives. You probably forgot about that, Brendan. Since 1996, and he's now the Federal Minister, of course, for Education, Science and Training. It's the education component that I believe he's going to address today. Indeed, some of you probably saw references to this on the front page of this morning's Australian newspaper. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Brendan Nelson.
Thank you very much, Robert, and members of the South Australian Press Club, ladies and gentlemen who've attended today in spite of the fact that I'm the speaker, and of course the sponsors of the Press Club, thank you so much for the support that you provide to the dissemination of ideas and information in modern South Australian society. Robert's introduction alluded to the fact that my electorate, Bradfield, which is on the upper north shore of Sydney, is a very strong Liberal-held seat, and you might be interested to know that when I made my first contribution to a ministry meeting after I'd been appointed Parliamentary Secretary for Defence, one of my colleagues broke the silence by saying to me, "Brendan, Bradfield is a safe seat, but your campaign to make it marginal continues unabated." So, if you're wondering what's on the mind of the next generation, I can give you some insight into that from two experiences I've had recently. The first was when a young university student arrived to interview me for Honi Soi, which is the student magazine for the University of Sydney. His opening question was, "Dr. Nelson, are you going to show solidarity with students and get your earring back in?" So, but as a constituent said to me before I removed it, she said, "My 17-year-old daughter told me to tell you you're out of date because you've only got one and it's in your ear." So the second experience I had was when Parliament's sitting, we have schools. We visit Canberra, of course, and I was receiving the Lindfield Public School, a primary school from within my electorate just before Christmas. And I generally speak to the kids about why you go into politics and what you do. And generally, I say to them, "Look, you only have one life and one opportunity to use your life to see that the kind of Australia that you leave your children, or you leave them when they are, as my teenage daughter said to me last year, half dead at the age of 43, that you see that that Australia is perhaps even better than the one that was bequeathed to us." Then the first question I get is, "Dr. Nelson, why is it that the hair on one side of your head sticks up higher than the other?" So, needless to say, as I pointed out to their science teacher, the tensile strength of some parts of your anatomy seems to increase as you go through your life. But, I must say that I didn't expect to receive the privilege of being able to serve as Australia's first Education, Science and Training Minister in Cabinet for the first government elected in the 21st century. But I was just saying to Robert and some of the guests at his table that every day that I have the privilege to do this job is a blessing. And it's a blessing because it's all about our future. When Sir Winston Churchill addressed Harvard University in 1943, in a rather prescient address, he said that the empires of the future would be empires of the mind. And the following year, here in Australia, when Sir Robert Menzies addressed the founding members of the Liberal Party of Australia, in October 1944, he said in part, "To every good citizen, the state owes not only a chance in life, but a self-respecting life." And embedded in those two statements by two statesmen from different countries is not so much where Australian education has been, but very much a philosophy and a driving force which I intend to see will see us through whatever period I have to be the minister. At the war's end, 2 years after Churchill had addressed Harvard, the world was characterised by 100 segmented markets, and Australia's place in it had been defined culturally and economically by engagement in two world wars and agrarian, land and labour-intensive industries based primarily on the exploitation of natural resources in mining, agriculture and manufacturing. And when you think of us as Australians today, who look back on that from the safe but paradoxically insecure distance of 60 years, in a world and in a country that's rapidly changing, in a country that's moving on to new horizons and challenges undreamt of perhaps only a decade ago, especially for those Australians who are living at the epicentre of economic and cultural changes that are being worked into our society, you can understand why there is a sense of unease in many parts of this country. And perhaps it's into that context that in particular our consideration of where Australian higher education should be placed needs most importantly to be put. We're a population of 19 million people. We're 0.3% of the world population. We're still only 1% of world trade and 6% of APEC. And we're living in a world that's now coalescing into three major trading blocs, and there is no place to hide from the winds of reform. And by that, of course, we mean the things that we as human beings most fear, and that's change. As I said, and I am privileged to represent the electorate of Bradfield on Sydney's Upper North Shore, most of the people that I represent want Australia to be a republic. They readily embrace the share market. They see Australia in every economic and cultural sense as being a part of the rest of the world. And when they raise issues of information communication technology with me, it's usually about slow internet access. But I say to them that when you go from the Opera House, or the Melbourne Cultural Arts Centre, or the Brisbane Exhibition Centre, and you go to the outer suburbs of our large cities, some regions of Australia, and indeed much of rural Australia, you find that many Australians feel a sense of economic, educational and technological disengagement from many of those Australians, perhaps, whom I'm privileged to represent. When I was opening the Tweed Heads campus of Southern Cross University 2 weeks ago, which was attended by about 60 people, it's a facility which specialises in particular in information communication technologies, interactive video teleconferencing, and a whole range of new modalities. I said to them that if you think back on it, 100 years ago, there probably would have been 2,000 or 3,000 people there to open the 20th century equivalent of what that and other institutions of learning are doing across Australia. And that is that a century ago, we would have been opening train lines. And most Australians, and I know South Australians in particular, understand the importance of rail infrastructure, the important role that it played in the development, economic and cultural, of the 20th century, and that it will continue to play in this. But the rail lines for the 21st century will be increasingly, as was foreshadowed by Churchill and others, be based in knowledge and education and information. And those industries who made this country what it is will continue to be important, and enhancing and adding value to those traditional commodities will be found very much in knowledge and in the application of science. But the next generation and I know South Australians in particular understand this better than most, are more likely to find that their careers will be based very much in industries, in knowledge, in health and education, telecommunications, biotechnologies, and a whole range of emerging industries. In thinking about and articulating the vision of education in Australia, there are two things I'd just like to relate to you. The first is that just before Christmas in 1997, one of my constituents, people cease to be human beings in this job, they become constituents, but he sent me a book authored by a German physicist and philosopher called Bernhard Filbert, and it's a fairly heavy theological read about change, how people effect and manage change individually and institutionally. And in reflecting on change, Filbert said, "Progress leads to chaos if not anchored in tradition. Tradition becomes rigid if it does not prepare the way for progress. But a perverted traditionalism and a misguided progressivism propel each other toward a deadly excess, hardly leaving any ground between them." And if you think about where our country is today, having crossed the threshold from the 20th to the 21st century, there are traditionalists in this country whose hard work, sacrifices and values made Australia what it is, in all kinds of industries and artistic and cultural efforts, who seriously question whether those who are driving change really will see what is important to them as being the foundation of the future. And at the other end are progressivists who seemingly want educational, technological, economic and cultural change for its own sake, who neither understand nor, worse still, even care about the concerns of the traditionalists. And in relation to higher education, about which I'll speak specifically in a moment, I think that that could also be observed and said of Australia's universities. The second thing that drives me are two photographs. The first is when you walk into my ministerial office in Canberra, is a framed photograph which would be the size of the Telstra sign immediately behind me. And it is a photograph of the late Neville Bonner. And the reason that it is there, Bonner, of course, was the first Aboriginal Australian to be elected to the federal parliament. And the reason it's there is because Bonner, who had only 1 year of formal education at Beau Desert High School, who did 3 grades in 1 year, who'd been denied an education by virtue of poverty, and by the fact that non-Indigenous parents would not allow an Indigenous person to attend a primary school south of Lismore, Bonner said before he died that his grandmother had taught him a number of things, but the most important was that if he could learn to read and write and communicate and have the courage to express his ideas and treat people with decency, that he would go a long way. And he also said before he died that in his experience of the world, the two commodities that we certainly needed much more of were human compassion and understanding. The second photograph, which is a more recent addition to my office, which sits immediately behind my desk, is a photograph of me, that's not right there, a photograph of me with a young woman called Tara Thompson. And Tara Thompson lives in the southern suburbs of Adelaide. And she is one of a number of young people in this city whose lives have been turned around by virtue of Hallett Cove Youth Pathways Project and a series of programs run through the Southern Adelaide Educational Program. And the reason her photograph is there is because I think that our vision of education in Australia needs to be that all of us should see education as about learning, a process that begins not long after we are born and which continues fairly much throughout our lives until almost the end of it. That we should see education as being different from training, but each of them are important and complementary. And as a person who's had more training than education, we need to understand not only the difference between education and training, but also the importance of knowing that difference. That acquiring a set of skills for a job, a utilitarian objective, is one that will give us skills that might last only 5 to 7 years before they need to be upgraded or indeed trained. But it's education that gives us resilience for life itself. That we should encourage young people to remain at school for as long as they are able, to preferably complete year 12, and to see an horizon that includes higher education and the importance of undertaking university degrees. But we are equally determined that young people in the early and middle part of their secondary education know that there are choices available to them, which include vocational education and training, which include TAFE, which include new apprenticeships and traineeships, and the decisions that they make, if they choose to undertake any one of those choices, that the young person who decides that they will undertake a training through TAFE or do an apprenticeship, that their lives, their educational and career choices are no less important to us than those who choose and are able to go on to higher education. And Tara Thompson is important because as a young woman, I phoned her, I'd only been in the job 5 days, and I rang this young woman and we had a talk about some of the problems that she had experienced, and I won't relate them to you directly, but needless to say, they are substantial. And she had just completed a first aid certificate, and she is as proud of that certificate as I am of the medical degree. She is now undertaking a course at TAFE, and the whole message to remind me is when I go to Australian universities, and as happened to me in the last 2 weeks, a large group of students from a large Australian university say to me, the only thing we care about is what happens to students and what happens to students in this university. What I say to them is, of course it's important what happens in universities, but you should not ever forget the hard work of many Australians individually and in business whose taxes essentially underwrite education in all its forms, including in higher education. You know, it's interesting, I was standing outside last week, the Queensland University of Technology. And I said to this woman standing next to me, who, you know, is how people sort of recognise you, but they're sort of a bit embarrassed to say hello. So I said hello to this lady, and I said to her, what do you think about university? She said, I don't know, really. She said, I applied to go to one once, but I didn't get in. And I said, oh, okay. She said, are you going in there? And I said, yes, I am. I'm going to meet the management team, meet students, get a good feel for QUT. She said, you might tell them something for me when you're in there. She said, I work really hard. She said, I know that my taxes help pay for what people learn inside that university. She said, but when they apply for the same job I'm applying for, they're more likely to get it. She said, can you just let them know that. And I think that whatever our concerns are, as they should be for Australian higher education, we should not ever forget that there are Australians whose determination is to feed their kids, their car loans and their mortgages, who have not ever seen the inside of an Australian university, who dream that their children might do, whose needs and aspirations in this regard are no more or less important than that of anybody else who spent a lifetime committed to higher education. When I came into the portfolio, within 3 weeks, I had made a decision, the culmination of which is today, which I'm about to outline to you. And the decision that I made was that the status quo for Australian universities will be very difficult to sustain. There are people in the sector who argue that there is a crisis in Australian higher education. And I understand why they argue that there is a crisis. And I just say to those who argue that there is a crisis in Australian higher education, if you want to see a crisis in education, go to the Northern Territory and go to places outside of Darwin and Alice Springs. And then come back and you'll be able to tell me that only 16 of 378 Aboriginal children can pass a basic Year 3 reading test, and only 23 of 369 can pass a basic Year 5 reading test. I'd suggest that's a crisis in education. Where only a quarter of the kids in some communities in Arnhem Land even attend school. That's a crisis. Also, if you want to go and speak to Reverend Bill Cruz, who runs the Exodus Foundation in Sydney's inner west, when he's not feeding the poor, looking after prostitutes and drug addicts, he runs with Macquarie University a program out the back of the school for kids who've spent 5 years in the education system and then come along and say in a mentoring and tutoring program, oh, it's the black stuff you read. You want to talk about a crisis? Maybe that's a crisis. Or you want to talk about Australians, at least Australians of a working age, still two generations, who hear us talking about emails and internets and connectedness to the rest of the world, who still don't even know how to turn a computer on. Maybe that's the kind of a crisis to which we need to turn our minds, the first instalment of which I'll be making an announcement about shortly. And then I'd also say that a sector that's got $20 billion in fixed assets, $4.4 billion in liquid assets, borrowings of the sector at $426 million represent 2% of asset value, and revenues this year of $10.4 billion, almost $2 billion more than it had 6 years ago, I don't consider that there is any serious grounds for arguing that there is a crisis. But if you think about where we want Australian higher education to be, not this year or next year, but where it's going to be 10 or 20 years from now, we have to make very important decisions now about putting Australian higher education on a sounder footing for the 21st century. And today I am releasing the first of what will be a series of discussion papers to inform public debate on our challenges, the real challenges, serious challenges facing Australian higher education, and what our choices are as a society in relation to the policies that we might choose to adopt and implement. And the debate should not, under any circumstances, be confined to those who are privileged to work in Australian higher education or who are students of it. It is a debate which all Australians should be party to and which we all own, whether we've ever been to university, whether we understand what goes on in Australian higher education, or whether we think our children might ever need to do so. It's time also that I think we had the maturity to undertake this debate in a way which is free of the highly politicised and emotional language which has characterised the past. It seems that every time an Australian education minister says we need to have a look at Australian universities and think about changes and think about the future, we seem to descend very quickly into a kind of not only a partisan political kind of modus operandi, but almost as if people in the higher education sector dig into an entrenched position, which is often out of step with where the rest of the community is. The ideas and the different choices which are promoted in this first discussion paper are not government policy, but they are intended to stimulate a discussion and hopefully inform a discussion which is a little bit more informed than some which has passed the debate in the past. I have, with the support of the Secretary of my department, Dr. Penn Shergold, who is here today, established a specialist unit within the department to work specifically on higher education reform. That specialist unit is being overseen by Mr. Bob Goddard, who has been recommended to us by the Australian Vice-Chancellor's Committee. I have also formally invited the Business Council of Australia to nominate another person to join that specialist group. That group is producing the discussion papers, will be digesting the responses to them, and will also be undertaking some focused response work with organisations and individuals. I've also established and am announcing today the composition of a reference group which will directly advise me on the issues that are being put into the public arena, the responses from not only the broader Australian society but from different parts of the Australian higher education sector. And seeing we're in South Australia, you should know that Madeleine Woolley, who is the director of the Adelaide Institute of TAFE and the deputy chairman of the TAFE Directors Australia, will be on that reference group. She will be joined by Professor Denise Bradley, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of South Australia, and Mr. Robert Champion de Crisney, who of course has impeccable business credentials, as well as being the Chancellor of Adelaide University. It's my intention that the subsequent discussion papers will cover governance and administration within the sector, the interface between vocational education and training and Australian higher education, We'll also be looking specifically at finance, quality of teaching, research and scholarship, and a final paper on specialisation within the sector and regional engagement. A number of the issues that I think are important, critically important, is we need to ask ourselves, 13 years after John Dawkins amalgamated the colleges of advanced education and universities and the introduction of TECs, we need to ask ourselves what defines a university. To what extent does scholarship, teaching and research define a university? One Vice Chancellor said to me recently that of another institution, he said, I don't think things are all that good there. They put a lot of emphasis on teaching and there isn't much research. Similarly, there is an argument raging in Victoria about whether Melbourne University Private should be stripped of its title of a university because its research is entirely driven by business interests and commercial in confidence arrangements. Whatever the legitimacy of those two points of view as examples, it is important that not just philosophically but practically that we say now, well, yes, well, what does define a university? Could a university, for example, be an institution that engages in high-quality teaching, in scholarship, and in research which is predominantly focused on the regional, economic, and social needs of the area in which it is based? Is that an appropriate thing for us to be looking at? The second fundamental question is, who is going to university? Why are they going? We know that 4 out of 10 don't complete. One of those 4 comes back in. Of the 3 who don't complete, half leave in the first year. Why do they leave? Why are they there in the first place? What should we be doing to support those students to see that they are less likely to leave? And one of the reasons why I am so determined that young people feel that they can make choices in terms of education to which they in their hearts feel they are best suited, instead of meeting the unfulfilled ambitions of their parents and of society that are projected on, is that if young people feel that instead of doing what their parents often argue that they should do, or society says they should do because as a society we say to young Australians increasingly, success is a mobile phone, fashionable clothes, a BMW, an outstanding result in year 12, and if you don't achieve any or all of those things in all kinds of ways, then perhaps you are a disappointment. They are the messages that young people pick up early in their secondary education. And if any of you have spent much of your lives dealing with young people who are disengaged and you scratch the surface, you find beneath it, that is one of the things. So apart from the human dimension of this, there is also a question as to whether university places, where there will always be an attrition, always. Let's just make sure that as best we can, as a society, as educators and as parents, that people go there for the right reasons. The third issue is, which is covered in this paper, is how are students being taught and what scope might there be for more customised approaches to degree acquisition that recognises modules of learning completed through different providers at different times. Can you enrol in, for example, the University of South Australia and undertake courses in another institution and graduate from the University of South Australia with that degree? Of course you can. We, at the moment, do not run a funding and governance arrangement which makes it easy. How can we improve access of people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, Indigenous students, students with disabilities, and in particular students from rural and isolated parts of the country? One of the key issues that's canvassed in this paper and will be the subject of a standalone paper is specialisation. I went to one Australian university that runs 167 courses. 96 of the courses have fewer than 5 students enrolled. 20% of the units being offered in Australian universities have less than 5 students enrolled. More than 4,000 university units have only 1 student enrolled. Now, in many cases, there are sound arguments why that should be the case, but in many others, there are not. At the moment, what we do as a nation, what we, the Commonwealth Government, do, is we effectively say to universities, offer a smorgasbord. And we penalise, in a sense, universities that try to specialise and differentiate notwithstanding the fact that many of them have sought to do so under the current arrangements. We also have a one-size-fits-all funding model, and if I look forward into the future, which is such an important part of the job, there are 38 publicly funded universities. Can we have a funding arrangement which puts a sound foundation under universities that are in regions and universities which are described by some vice-chancellors as equity universities? Can we put a solid foundation under them financially, which encourages them to specialise and collaborate? At the same time, we might be able to enable one or two of Australia's larger institutions to genuinely aspire to be world-class and internationally competitive. Under the current arrangements, if we continue as we are, neither will be possible. Governance and administration is another area that will be the subject of a specific discussion paper. We need to look at governing bodies. Who's on governing bodies? Why are they on governing bodies? What roles do they have? What skills do they bring to the task? And at the moment, the university acts which establish universities are all different throughout the country. So what governs commercialisation of intellectual property or the management of physical resources in one state is quite different from that that exists in another. And in that regard in particular, the last thing that I want to do as the minister is prescribe to state and territory governments what they should do in this regard. We should come to this recognising that we as Australians, whatever our politics, have a common set of problems, and we should work as best we can together to see if we can address them. There are issues of workplace relations and universities needing the flexibility to be able to rapidly change course structures and course offerings to meet the needs in particular of students. The commercialisation of intellectual property, barriers to private sector investment in university infrastructure, they are again part of the issues we need to address. In other parts of the world, universities rely fairly heavily on business and industry engagement and investment. That is not the culture in Australia, and nor do all of the taxation and corporate governance arrangements make it relatively easy for universities and industries to do just that. One of the other real concerns, in fact, I often say to my colleagues that it's not the economic indices with which we're so understandably concerned that will define our future and our destiny as a people. It's our values, our beliefs, the way we relate to one another and see our place in the world. And universities, as John Nyland, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of New South Wales, said to me a couple of months ago, he said universities pass the soul from one generation to the next. And one of the concerns I think we should all have, where universities increasingly, as they must, look for private sources of funding, is what is the role for humanities, fine arts, philosophy, literature, language, and all of those things that define who we are and give meaning to our society? How do we protect them? How do we make sure that their place is secure in an environment which increasingly looks at commercialisation and private sector investment? And that will be covered at some length throughout the course of the review. One of the other problems facing the sector, I think, also is us. It is Commonwealth regulation. The extent to which my department regulates Australian universities is in itself an area that needs serious reform. Within the realms of public accountability, I am determined, in fact, the Secretary is currently looking at this, I am determined to see that we cut some of the red tape which exists between us and Australian universities, so the universities can spend more time teaching and researching and less time reporting to the Commonwealth government. And finally, but this is not by any means an inclusive list, I'm currently also working on some reforms which will assist the internationalisation and marketing of education from Australian universities. In concluding, I by way of summing this up, I referred to this when I spoke to the Melbourne Institute recently, but Sir Thomas Jefferson was the third president of the United States of America, which would have to be, if you had a CV and you had that you had been president of the United States, you'd probably rank that as the number one. But before he died, Jefferson was asked for what he'd like to be remembered. And he said, there are three things that I would like recorded on my headstone. The first is that I co-authored the American Declaration of Independence. The second is that I established the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. And the third is that I founded the University of Virginia. And when he was asked why that was the case, he said, it is because education is the defence of the nation. It is our defence. What will defend my children from prejudicial ignorance and fear of change, which will ensure more than anything else that they see themselves as being a part of the rest of the world and they have the resilience that they will require to see them through a world that is changing extremely quickly, is education. So thank you very much for listening to me, and I'll be very happy to take some questions.
Thank you, Brendan Nelson. Thomas Jefferson also, I think, liked a glass of red wine, and there's a glass of red wine for you on your table, but you've got to answer a few questions first. It is good, even for a sceptical journalist like myself, not cynical, but sceptical, to hear a politician who's passionate about what he does, and I think most of you have heard that talk today would agree that he is passionate about it. Some of you may have listened to Matt Abraham's Anzac Day broadcast yesterday on ABC Radio, and I was saying to the guests at my table and to Brendan Nelson just now that Matt played the famous speech that Paul Keating gave on the 11th of November 1993, where they interred the unknown soldier at the Australian War Memorial, which is just one of the greatest speeches that I've ever heard, certainly from an Australian politician. And he talked about the fact that that soldier would not have recognised the Australia of today. And Brendan Nelson touched on that just now in the way that, that things are changing, and indeed the way that our children's children, cannot comprehend what is coming. So therefore, in that spirit, I thank Brendan Nelson and give him a small gift to take away, that I'd ask for your questions, and the first questions go to working journalists. Ian Henschke.
Oh, Brendan, nice to see you. I thought it was a very good speech, and I'd like to thank you for having so much passion about education. It's a good thing. You may end up becoming the best Labor minister that Liberals have ever had, from the sounds of it. It's what we used to say about Tom Playford, the best Labor Premier South Australia ever saw. What I'd like to ask you relates to the ABC, which I've been working for the last 20 years, and when I joined the ABC, I joined as an education producer. Unfortunately, due to the government cutbacks, not under your regime, but under the Labor regime, the ABC actually closed down its education departments all around Australia. We used to make radio programs for schools, radio and television. At the moment, there's a very small education unit in Adelaide that makes Behind the News and a few other programs. So Charles Moses, when he was asked after 30 years at the top of the ABC what his greatest achievements were, like Thomas Jefferson, gave the surprising answer. It was the creation of the ABC Education Department, the creation of the ABC Orchestras, and the creation of the News and Current Affairs Department, in that order. So Moses actually thought that what he was doing was providing education for people. Last year, the ABC board asked for money from the federal government for the National Initiative Program to actually create educational program above its triennial funding. The only funding we got was for the regional and rural Australia projects, which was seen by some people as a sop to the Pauline Hanson, who Bob, by the way, didn't mention, spoke here a while ago, but Pauline was out on the trail, and about that time the government gave money to the ABC to make regional and rural programming. I was wondering whether you see the national broadcasters having a key role in education, and whether you, in Cabinet, will go into bat next time round and say, I think the ABC could play a good role to get those kids in the Northern Territory the education programs that they want, plus the catalysts and all those other programs that we run in general programming. What about the general issue of using the ABC as an education network?
Well, thanks very much, Ian. As you in setting higher education reform and other things in a context, obviously I made the point of which we're all painfully aware is that the country is changing, and it's changing very quickly. Certainly when I was at school, I do remember receiving ABC educational programs of one sort or another. The question for me is, and I don't know whether this is the case, is whether the kind of educational programming the ABC might be able to offer is already available to schools through other more modern, other modern modalities. I don't know whether that's the case. If there is certainly...
I think it'd be easy enough to find out, but when they closed it down, there are no radio and television programs being made around Australia for schools, other than a few.
Look, I'm happy to... you're the first person who's raised it with me. I haven't had any state minister, I haven't had anybody from schools or anybody else raise it with me at all. I'd be very happy to consider, is there a need, what's the extent of that need, and is it something that a need that needs to be met by Commonwealth and or state or territory governments, and if so, would the ABC be an appropriate organisation to run it? So happy to take it on notice.
Christopher
Gelly,
you can't keep a good politician down. I think that they're standing for the board of the ABC again.
Yes. Christopher Gelly,
go ahead.
Dr. Nelson, two questions. One, you have an SA background. You went to high school here. You studied at Flinders. Do you still have SA ties? The second question, you alluded to the dangers of change, and also mentioned the dedication of tradition. Is it at all possible in your mind to get any true balance between dangers and advantages of change? Dangers and advantages of change.
Well, in terms of SA ties, I've got a crow's tie and I've got a SA great tie, if you remember that campaign. I've still got family who live in South Australia, and having spent 2 years completing my secondary education with the Jesuits at Athelstan, I can assure you they never let go. The issue of change, it's a very interesting thing, and Ian knows perhaps better than anybody at ABC has been going through this, amongst other things. But I, in a previous life, my wife would say when I had one, when I was president of the AMA, it was a very similar sort of thing. I was dealing with professional people who are generally highly intelligent and trained and a bit of education, many of whom would spend their entire days trying to work out and develop new ways of approaching old problems. But as a group, most resistant to any sort of general policy change. I found that you can shift people to where you think they need to go if they have a sense of vision, they need a campfire around which people sit and they reflect on and they understand the importance of where they've been, and they've also got a sense of leadership about where they need to go. And you can get people to rise above themselves and support something which on the face of it they may not necessarily agree with at first blush, if they understand the nature of the problem, where you believe they need to be going, and why they need to go there. I think the fundamental thing in reform in the sector, I think people need to know that universities are valued, that they are respected, that they are valued and respected not only for the economic contribution they make to our life, but also our cultural development. I think if the fundamentals are preserved in terms of ensuring good access for undergraduate teaching, that it's reasonably well distributed throughout the country, that there is an emphasis on humanities and social sciences as much as there is in science, engineering and technology, and they can be convinced that whatever reforms we ultimately propose will deliver a stronger higher education sector, I'd like to think most open-minded people will come with us.
Hi, John Murch from Radio Adelaide. Dr. Nelson, Premier Rann flagged in this room this time last week that he was seriously reviewing the school leaving age. Do you believe that this will improve the crossover to future training, if you're mentioning about university not being the only option? And if so, should there be further scope to include more diversity in Year 11 and 12?
Yeah, it's interesting. The secondary education system in Australia has really evolved to meet the needs of universities. and around 20, in fact 29% of students go directly from secondary school to university. And as a consequence of that, we've increasingly been putting vocational education and training modules into schools as a way of keeping kids at school, making school seem a little bit more relevant, and also giving them credit for things which employers are actually looking for in terms of skills. If the South Australian government decides to change the leaving age for students, and that is the only thing that it does, which I'm sure that the Premier is not suggesting, then I doubt that will make much difference at all. But what can make a difference is if the leaving age is increased at the same time that the education system is tracking where those kids are going. We know at the moment that 13% of kids are not going to university, not going to a job, not going to training, not going to TAFE. So just over 1 in 10 are lost to the system. If the age of school leaving increases, and the schools in some way are supported in tracking the kids are where they are in the system, then that might actually deliver a better outcome for us. I just think it's very important. We've now got 190,000 kids throughout the country doing vocational education. Which they get credit. We've got 10,500 kids doing apprenticeships whilst they're still at school. I'll shortly be announcing some initiatives to take that, ratchet that even further up. And I think that states can do some complementary things which assist us in that. That certainly sounds like one of them.
Minister, my name is Cliff Walsh. I'm a very privileged person. For 30-something years now, I've been a member of what's called Academe, and that is, my career has been underpinned by that. In very early stages of my career, I said to friends that there were a number of jobs which I ever looked like I was seriously interested in. They should shoot me because I'd lost my marbles. And one of those jobs was anything senior in a university in an administrative sense. And people will say I've done other things that I should have been shot for, including working for a former prime minister. But the question I really have here is within the university system, and we produce administrators, vice-chancellors and so on, I mean, who come from within our system, who seems to me have very little skills in management and so on. And I heard you saying your review is going to focus on governance. I wonder if that's broad enough to encompass the whole set of issues about how management within universities actually organised and so on. The second point I'd like to make is, I mean, I left the mainstream of the university system about 14 years ago and have subsequently been largely running research centres still within the university system, but here we're having to draw on essentially private sector or competitive government funding. And one of the reasons I did that was because I got tired of being called an academic wanker. I was to prove that I didn't need tenure in order to sort of sustain a career within the university system. I think the tenure issue is still a very live issue for your review, or how tenure is organised. And secondly, the other sort of conclusion I've drawn from that experience is that in trying to draw in money from the private sector in particular, there is still a very dominant view that universities are funded by the government, and that the private sector shouldn't be asked to underwrite what the government should be funding. And I just wonder how you envisage your review actually broaching that question about the role of the private sector in helping to sustain a vigorous and internationally competitive university system.
Well, thank you very much, Cliff. If I had made some of the remarks you just made, I think I'd be shocked. But especially in relation to vice-chancellors. The review's obviously already working already. We've got some provocative opinions being put in the public arena. I think on the first question, it seems if you were... Some of these universities are $300-400 million operations. If you were designing a good business management approach for Australian higher education today for the 21st century, I suspect it wouldn't be precisely the model with which we now work. A number of the universities have sought to move around the structures, but we will be looking in some detail at governance, and I think one of the problems that the Vice-Chancellors, every single one of them, are extraordinary people, have achieved mind-boggling things throughout their lives. But I think one of the problems that we have is that they come up through academic life, they bring to the Vice-Chancellor's position a variety of skills. They actually have to work with the people who decide whether they will be in the job or not. In looking at university councils and boards, for example, the business expertise brought to them varies from zero, like no business expertise at all, right through to 68%. Now, somewhere along that spectrum ought to be an ideal balance. Should we have people who come to university councils who are, as I say, trustees? People who are there because you say that person has an ideal set of skills with which to administer this particular institution. So we'll be looking very closely at that. And of course there will be resistance to even discussing the idea. But again, I come back to it. I sit in my department. I'm responsible for $16 billion of public money. And I sit in my department, every cent of that money, someone has worked damned hard to provide. And we've got to make sure that when it goes, in this case, into Australian universities, that it is well spent, it's efficiently administered and invested where people want it to be. And I know that at the moment that cannot be said of all Australian universities. The second issue, in terms of business investment and business involvement, I think we certainly do need a lot more. There is a long way to go. I said to the chairman of a very large company not so long ago, I said, well, why couldn't your company, for example, build the XYZ Centre for ICT Excellence and then go into a 30-year intellectual property sharing agreement, for example, the university? And he said, well, actually, we'd be interested in something like that, but it's very, very hard to do in Australia. So that's the kind of thing that I want to look at. But the challenge in doing that is we want to make sure that we don't end up in a situation where the only thing that gets funded in a university is that which can attract private sector funding. I mean, languages and history and philosophy and all of those things are critically important. The question is whether, I mean, you go to a university, you have one lecture room which has got people standing outside who you can't possibly fit them all in. And then the one next door will be a tutorial size room with a very small number of students. And you say, well, why can't another university offer the smaller size course for those students, and then the larger number of students can have staff redirected into that activity, and then so as a nation we have the field of endeavour provided, but done so in a more collaborative and, dare I say, rational way.
Last question, thanks.
And I'll be quick. Dr. Nelson, until recently, I spent 10 years as the head of a marketing organisation of one of the universities in Queensland, and I'm a graduate of it, and I'm very interested in what you're saying. One of the things, two things to concern me. One, about 4 years ago in South Australia, there was a division, Parliament actually looked at the way universities run, and the result was actually pretty good. They chopped councils down to about 20 members. Some are quite large. Most councils now are at least 50% people off campus. And that's, in my opinion, having spent, also I was a member of council for 5 years, very interesting. However, one of the problems is, and I can say this now because I'm retired, is that when your chief executive, i.e. the vice chancellor, wishes to push certain things, it's extremely difficult to ignore or go against the person who you actually hired who allegedly has their expertise. I'm not then saying that vice chancellors are all stupid or do stupid things, but it's a difficult thing to say to a chancellor or vice chancellor, you're wrong. And if you do so, of course, you have a crisis. And allowing that many vice chancellors are strong personalities, as they should be, that's one problem. The second thing you raised, which caused me some concern, working for a graduate of a university which you would have to describe as small, moderate, but good. Obviously, you were a graduate.
That's right.
You did say, should we have one or two places, large places, I think you said, of excellence. Could not a small university doing one or two things also be in the centre of excellence?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. When I appeared on the Channel 9 program at Borry Oaks recently, I deliberately injected the comment about Australia aspiring to have one or two institutions. Well, there are already parts of Australian institutions that are world best. I mean, like, not the top 50, but like world best. But should Australia aspire to have one or two in the top 50 20 years from now? And a number of universities have already set that as their objective. In looking at the current funding arrangements, I struggle to see that it will be possible. But nonetheless, they should aspire to be so. But the reason for saying it was not to say, well, look, this university and that one, we'll carve them off and they can compete with the best, whatever league table you use. The reason for saying it was to... I said to the Vice-Chancellors when I first met them before Christmas, the administrative group of the ABCC, I said, your problem is characterised by this. I spent 2 days door knocking in Campbelltown in Western Sydney during the federal election with Pat Barnett. Only two people said anything to me about education. Only two. And they said the same thing. Why is the Labor Party against you sending kids to private school? Now, that in itself is no argument for saying, well, we shouldn't be concerned about universities or anything of the sort. That's not what I'm suggesting. But what it reflects is a sense of disengagement that a lot of Australians have for the issues that are of concern to universities and vice-chancellors and people who teach within them. And the reason for saying what you've got to do is you've got to get the person who's looking for footy results in the Sunday Mail at the weekend to say to themselves when they're talking to their husband, their wife or whatever, to say, oh, geez, no, Port Power's up again, that's great. I'm a bit concerned Australia doesn't have a world-class university. You know, we ought to make whatever's wrong out there, we ought to fix it. So it's a way of bringing more Australians into the debate. The second reason for doing it is to get people to focus on the problems. Because the way the system is at the moment, we will not ever have a world-class, whatever league table you use, we will not ever, in my view, have a world-class institution. That's all of it. So that's the reason for that. In relation to the governance and administrative issues, it's not my place from the Commonwealth point of view to tell state governments what they should or shouldn't do. But there's got to be some logic that starts to apply to some of this. And I find I think the worst job in the world must be being a vice-chancellor. It's very hard to run a large organisation to direct the people who basically have put you into the job, with whom you've got to work on a day-to-day basis, and frequently to be put into that job not because your management expertise is the number one thing that you bring to it. And I think we ought to have, as I say, the maturity, and my colleagues would say the courage, to have a bit of a talk about it.
Please come across that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I didn't realise that Colin Rubb was crawling up behind you like a shark. I'd like you to ask direct questions rather than discursive questions, and I'll show you what I mean, because I'm going to ask one myself now. Dr. Nelson, you're an honest man, I can see that. I'd like you to answer this question directly. In the appropriate circumstances, would you have the Prime Minister's baton in your medical bag?
Someone asked me something like that the last time I was here, and which I think was you. I've acquired a lot more than just grey hair in the intervening period. I can assure you, I've got my head down doing my job. We've got major challenges ahead in education and in science and training. Every day I'm in this job is a blessing. I don't have any aspirations other than to see that whenever I finish this job, the people say, I think we did a good job.
But he didn't say no.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. I'm Helen Kavanagh. I'm from the University of Adelaide Council. I'm a postgraduate student member of that council. And I thought it was interesting, some things that you said about Indigenous people not being able to read or having low scores. To me, it would be a university educated person who will teach those people to read, and preferably, of course, an Indigenous university-educated person. The same thing with people with computer skills, whatever socioeconomic background they might come from. I would hope that it was a university-educated person from that background who was able to teach those people, and I think the Commonwealth Government would have a big say in those people getting that education. I'm very pleased to hear that Detcher/Death now realises the difference between education and training, and I'll be sure to pass that on to all the other postgrads I know. But my real question is the rest of your portfolio about science in particular and training. And the research training scheme is a very small part of funding that comes from the federal government into education and innovation and research. So I'm thinking about the bit that goes to business and the fact that it's not only workers who bank for Port Adelaide that pay taxes, but there are whole other areas of our community that pay taxes, that are involved in research and innovation, but not involved in universities. And it's the philanthropic nature of business. And I wondered if your department had any feelings about what you might do about that.
What we might do about the philanthropic nature of business. Well, it's interesting that all of the vice chancellors, you'll be reassured to know, generally start a conversation by saying we need more public money. Once we get that beyond that issue, there are a number of things that I speak to them about. But one of them is the idea of how do we create a culture where in Australia that they do feel that it's the right thing to do to support and invest in higher education, infrastructure, and also the human capital within them. But you also need to be looking at the taxation issues, which we will be looking at, which are seen by business to be impediments. The Australian Industry Group, the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the Business Council of Australia will be playing a role alongside people within the sector in this review and reform process. And I, for example, think we ought to be looking at the tax incentives for investment in infrastructure. We need to be looking at the taxation treatment of researcher and university employee held equity in intellectual property. We should be looking at the taxation and other administrative barriers to commercialising ideas in this country. There's a lot of argument, I notice, about investment by Australian superannuation funds and it going offshore. And those in the finance sector, I think you know better than I, of course, why that's the case. But we're not creating an environment in this country at the moment which actually makes it attractive for them to look at higher education. So I can assure you, most certainly.
Thank you very much, Brendan Nelson, and thank you all for coming along. It's good to see the Adelaide City Council well represented here at this table in front of me, and have been regular supporters, so it's very good. I don't propose to allow any more questions, but anyone wants to talk to Brendan Nelson, if he's prepared to stay for a few minutes and enjoy that glass of red wine sitting in front of him, I'm sure he wouldn't mind talking to you. But we do have a commitment in this club to try and finish as close to 2 p.m. as possible to let you get back to whatever you want to do, and I thank you very much for coming. Brendan Nelson, we have our traditional thank you gift. Which on this occasion is a very nice bottle. This is one you haven't had before, I think, of Jacob Creek Limited Release 1994 Shiraz Cabernet, which I can assure you is a superb magnum of good wine. He told me on the way in, thank you very much. You told me the way in that the last one we gave him, which is 91, I think, wasn't it? Not 91 St. Hugo Pinot Cabernet from our wine sponsor, Orlando, that he drank it at Christmas. With a friend, which is not a bad effort anyway. So as he knows, the doctor, of course, that drinking red wine is good for your heart. Brendan Nelson, thank you very much for coming along, and we appreciate the thought and the passion that went into what you said. Please go on. We will have you back when you're Prime Minister. I'd like to get Susan Karakousis and Judith Fletchmore up here to sort out the raffle. And I thank them both, by the way, for the passion which they put into helping run this show. Thank you all very much.
And I just have one minor change. We were talking about Wayne Jackson before, and the date for that is actually July 12th. Both of our next functions will be held here at the Hyatt, for those of you who get a little bit confused when we do move around. So May 30th for business, and July 12th in Wayne Jackson. Now, we've got all the raffle tickets here. Am I going to draw? Oh, that'll be a hoot. Blind as a bat. Crippled. Not doing very well at all. The first prize is for cordless telephone. Telstra. Thank you, Telstra, as always. Steve Weber, Table 8. Then we have some very nice wine brought in by our wonderful Robert Main, who knows just so much about wine, thank goodness. The next one is Nick Kahn, A72 Green. Well done. Two more bottles of wine from our sponsors, Orlando, Grant McAvaney, and Minter Ellison. Right. Oh, Barry Halston, I think, from the Tizer. Come forward, Barry. I think you... Lucky last. Another green one. Ian Smythe. Oh, we had a head table dominance here. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You're free to enjoy yourselves for a little while. I think there are going to be a couple of doorstop interviews outside for Dr. Nelson. Other than that, thank you, and we look forward to seeing you on May the 30th.